and really has many years of experience in research into not only mechanisms but also treatments for major depression and a range of anxiety disorders, and has been a very important part in the development of our new research-based affective disorders service. You're co-director with India, C2AD. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Tim, to speak to us this afternoon. Over to you.
Thank you, Peter, and Cathy Ross for inviting me to come and talk. As Peter mentioned, I'm in the privileged position of working with basic science colleagues at the MRC CBU, where we try to understand fundamental aspects of affective disorders, and then also working in this new clinical research centre with the remit of trying to translate basic scientific knowledge through into clinical practice. And one of the things we're really focusing on is trying to develop new forms of clinical care, assessment, diagnosis and intervention, but also to try and elucidate how our existing evidence-based, NICE recommended gold standard treatments are actually working. And rather than overview the program more generally, I was just going to focus on one study stream that asks that kind of question today. So a relatively new psychosocial intervention, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and questions about what its mechanisms are. So obviously when you're doing a research project, especially when you're writing a paper, you get very focused down on how to answer the question, how to do all the analyses. And the good thing about giving a talk is it forces you to step back and think a little bit about the bigger picture. And it struck me, probably rather late in the day, that this was a bit of an odd question for us to be asking at all. Because surely, I'm sure, people who've been through these kind of psychological treatments would be horrified to think that we're still trying to wonder how they might be working. Because the whole rationale presented to service users from the outset is, this is how this treatment's going to help you, this is how it works. We've got loads of theory and research behind it, showing that this is what's going to go on. And so, why would we even need to be asking these questions at this point? And I think that kind of reflects a sort of collective delusion amongst clinical research and psychological treatments that's been going on for a long time, with completely understandable reasons, which is that we know how our psychological treatments work. And it's only really relatively recently that significant question marks have been raised about this assumption. And I think it all started with more traditional cognitive behaviour therapy, where there's a prototypical psychological treatment context in place, which is that we have a strong theory about how cognitive behavior therapy should be working. It's about identifying maladaptive cognitive processes, thought processes, meaning structures, which are implicated in the onset and maintenance and exacerbation of psychological problems. We develop treatments that ameliorate those or reverse them. We test the treatments, people get better, and so the assumption therefore is presumably they're getting better because of what we've done in the treatment, which is targeted at these processes which we know are problematic. And this obviously has gone on for a long time. And it was only really sort of 10 years ago or so that people started to say, well, let's inquire a bit more about how these mechanisms are operating in CBT, which we know must surely be there. And so they asked straightforward questions like, well, presumably cognitions are going to change more for people who've had CBT than people on, say, antidepressants. Presumably, the change in cognitions, the amount of cognitions are changing, is going to be related to how much you improve therapy. Presumably, the cognitions are going to be changing before people start to feel better, rather than the other way around. So basic questions that you would hope to just essentially be ticking off as you did your research. But what they found was almost no support for any of those things at all. So you can count really on one hand the number of papers that have successfully demonstrated that traditional CBT is working in that way. So, for example, cognitions change as much on antidepressants as they do following CBT. The relationship of change is the same if you've had antidepressants or whether you've had CBT, and often there's no relationship between how cognitions have changed changed considerably after people have actually recovered from symptoms and from cases, and so on and so on. And this has led people to think, well, we know that CBT works, and that's a good thing, but maybe it's not working at all in the way that we think it's working. And that's led to this general view of maybe we should start asking these questions for all of our evidence-based treatments. But the cynic could say, well, does it really matter? I mean, maybe we don't really know, well, we don't know how antidepressants work or other treatments for depression or other disorders. It's enough to know that they are working. And so does it really matter if they're not quite working the way that we think they're working? And I think there's two reasons why it does matter. The first is to do with the famous what's called the dodo bird effect. And this is an idea in psychological treatment research, which is basically you can help people with mild to moderate problems ever such a lot by just sitting down and listening to them in a non-judgmental way, meeting them once a week, making a nice cup of tea, and so on and so forth. There's a huge amount of non-specific therapeutic factors which can make people feel better. And it's called the dodo bird effect after Alice in Wonderland, where there was a very complicated race which the dodo bird was in charge of, and no one could clearly tell who's won or if everyone was properly. Very like an RCT in the NHS. I don't really any idea what's going on. And the dodo bird famously said, well, everyone's a winner and everyone shall have prizes. And there's this view that psychological treatments are like that. You can't really go wrong. You're going to get a lot of benefit just from spending time with people in a way that isn't like what they have with their families and friends. And so that's one reason, because obviously doing that is much easier and cheaper than these highly specialised psychological treatments. So if all you have to do is train people up to do these very non-specific things, then it's going to have a huge economic impact on the way we deliver treatment. So we need to know if it's the specialised processes which we think are active in our psychological treatments which are doing the business, or if it's these more generic factors. And the second reason, I think, is that even the best psychological treatments really only helping about half the people that they're targeting at, and that's anxiety disorder. So as soon as you go into mood disorders, it drops considerably. And then lots of those people are still going to be relapsing later. And so if the treatment was 100% effective, you'd be less concerned perhaps about how it's working. But if it's not, then you need to be always thinking about how you can improve that. And to improve it, you need to know why it's working and why it's not working for some people, and who it works best for, and so on and so forth. So you need to start asking questions about that. So I think it's really important to understand how our treatments are working so that we can improve them, and so we can check that we really do need all of these extensively trained therapists to do. You can see that I thought these big picture thoughts after I'd sent the slides and had no slides whatsoever, so I'm just drawing on. Yes, so what we wanted to do was ask those questions about this treatment, MBCT. And of course, you're not going to do that in a vacuum. You are going to hope that the best place to start when you ask these questions is the very theory that led to the intervention in the first place. You're going to hope that that's going to deliver the results that you want. So you're not just going to pick variables out of nowhere. And of course, when you're thinking about the theory and the rationale for the treatment, best place to start to think about that is the clinical problem in the first place, because it's that you need to conceptualise when you're coming up with treatment. And in this case, the clinical problem is depression relapse. So everybody knows that depression has a huge global health burden, and the health economist's favoured metric of quality adjusted life years, the estimate is that depression will be second only to cardiac problems by 2020 is in terms of its global impact on health. So it's right up there as one of the most significant health concerns in the world. So we know it's a big deal. And a lot of that problem is because it recurs. So if you have an episode of depression, you've got about a 50-50 chance, maybe a bit more, that you're going to have another episode. But once you get to three episodes, pretty much certain that you've now got a recurrent lifelong condition. And in the studies that I'm going to talk about, we had people with 20, 30, 40 episodes of depression. And I think that the mean was 6 or 7. So it's a recurrent condition, and this contributes a lot to its burden. Another interesting thing about recurrence of depression is this idea called kindling. And this is the notion that when generally speaking, when people have earlier episodes of depression, they're much more tied into bad things that are happening in their lives. They're much more reactive. But that as episodes continue through the trajectory, later episodes are much more about what's going on with inside the person and what's going on within their lives. So the diaphysis stress balance changes a lot. And for 3 or more episodes, very small stresses can lead to relapse. So recurrent conditions do have a bit of a silver lining, which is that there is a period here when you can work with people, work with services, is when they're actually not suffering from a depressive episode. So they're actually feeling relatively okay, they're in partial remission or full remission, and it's much easier, as everyone knows, for psychological treatment to work with people who feel a bit more able to engage with it. And so the good thing is that for a recurrent condition, you have the option of doing a relapse prevention intervention program rather than just working with people when they're in the midst of an episode. Of course, the downside of that is that anyone who's tried to get service commissions to fund relapse prevention programs, it's much more difficult than if you've got people who are really struggling. So we've got clear clinical need. There's a reluctance to spend money when people are actually okay. So it's got good and bad stuff too. But MBCT is aimed at this juncture, trying to work with people when they're feeling relatively okay to develop skills to prevent future relapse, which we know once you've had 3 episodes, it's almost guaranteed to happen. So currently, the main way we do this, relapse prevention in the UK, is antidepressant medications, I'm sure everybody knows. The problem is that the trials show that antidepressants are likely, if you say do a year post recovery from an episode, you've got about a 67% chance of recurrence within a year, even on full maintenance antidepressant. So they are helping, and a lot of people obviously swear by them, but there's certainly a need to do a bit more. Also, lots of people don't like being on antidepressants for long periods of time as a maintenance relapse prevention. So the first thing you need then, if you're going to come up with an alternative, is some theoretical understanding of why do people relapse into depression when they've had it before, and why does this seem to get more and more likely as they have more and more episodes, and why does this kindling effect occur? Why is it that that there needs to be less and less external stress to facilitate these episodes? And this is the sort of simple model that underlies MBCT. So basically it says everybody can end up having bad experiences and lapsing into a negative mood. And yeah, that's obviously the case. But there's a qualitative difference between the negative moods that people who are vulnerable to depression, who have had depression in the past, enter, and the negative moods that people who are less vulnerable enter. And this is known as the differential activation. A different set of mental structures come online, invade the person's mind if they're vulnerable to depression. And the key ones are this sort of sense of extreme sort of somatization and unmotivated feelings in the body. But as far as mindfulness is concerned, the other key one is the sorts of mental structures that are activated when people vulnerable to depression move into. So these are best conceptualized as models of the self and the world that are extremely pejorative. So I'm a worthless person, I'm weak, I'm rubbish, no one likes me, I'm never going to be any good at anything, I'm never going to get past this. So imagine if every time something small happened that dipped your mood, all these things start crowding into your mind, you can see how that would lead you into a cycle which could bring on depressive episodes. And what seems to happen as episodes numbers increase over the lifespan, is that this relationship here just becomes more and more oiled, if you like. So these states come online much, much more quickly the more episodes a person has. So these are the sorts of dysfunctional beliefs that I'm sure anyone who's worked with people with depression would recognise. That underpin these kind of states, the sort of beliefs that it's impossible to maintain, and so when events happen and you've got these kind of mental structures guiding your self-models, then of course you're going to feel bad about yourself. I can't be happy unless most people admire me. If I fail, then I'm useless as a person. If someone disagrees with me, it's probably because they don't like me. And given that we encounter people who don't admire us all the time, work has its ups and downs, and we always have disagreements, if you respond to all of them in this kind of way, then you're going to be in trouble. So these are just some examples of the sorts of things that come on board in this theoretical understanding. So the first thing you need to do when you've got a model like this, of course, is to try and find some evidence to support it. And this is the first stage of developing treatment. Is this really just fancy ideas coming from talking to patients? Or is there genuinely a sense that there's a qualitative difference between... Is that what you have to do? Is there really a qualitative difference between people who are vulnerable to depression and people who never been depressed? So, in the laboratory, you can develop a task that tries to tap this. So what you do is you measure these kind of self-related beliefs. You measure these kind of self-related beliefs when people are feeling fine. So you've got two types of person. You've got somebody who's had, say, three or four episodes of depression in the past but feels okay. And then you've got somebody who's never been depressed. And you say, could you endorse and could we discuss some of the ways you think about yourself? What you find is that you can't really detect any difference whatsoever between these two groups of people. When everybody's feeling fine, depressed people aren't saying, if someone disagrees with me, at least they don't like me. If I fail at something small, if something big, they're not saying this at all. They're saying just the same sort of thing. And you measure their mood to check that they're feeling alright. Then you induce this sad mood that's supposed to diverge these two groups of people in the laboratory. And there's all sorts of ways you can do this. Rather worryingly, one way is just to put someone in a room and say, just think about yourself in your life for 5 minutes. And for most people, that sends their mood. But if you want a slightly more reliable way, what we tend to use is you play in this really sad music. So you've got music by, say, Prokofiev, Russian Under the Mongolian Yoke, it's incredibly sad. And then you cut it down to half the speed, which makes it even more sad. And then you give people a list of terribly negative statements about, potentially about their lives, such as when your friends meet behind your back, they all talk about how they don't like you. And pretty much sends everybody's mood right down. Yeah? And then you do these measurements again. And this is where you find that the people who've never had a problem with depression are feeling pretty miserable, but they're still not endorsing any of these quite catastrophic strategies at all. But the people who are vulnerable to depression, suddenly all of these things come on board, and they're very clearly feeling them. After what is obviously a mood induction, an intense mood induction, but it's not a really, really big major life event. So you've got some evidence there that there really is this sense of differential activation. But the question is then, well, does that really have anything to do with relapse? It's possible that within 10 minutes, everybody's just back to their stuff with it. It's nothing to do with relapse. There was a great study by Zimbal Siegel, published in archives a few years ago, which looked at this. And they had a large group of patients, and they did this reactivity measure that I talked about, the extent to which these cognitions come on board after this mood induction procedure. And they split people into those who had a big reactivity increase, i.e. lots of these things started to populate their mind. These are people who've recovered from depression. People who, if anything, actually felt slightly better after the mood induction, and then people for whom it didn't really have any effect at all. And then they followed them up over 8 months and said, well, of these three groups, what percentage are likely to remain depression-free over that time? And what you can see is that the percent of patients not relapsing is much smaller in the high reactivity group. So the more people were reactive on this laboratory task, the much greater chance that they have of not getting through the next year and a half of that depressive episode. So, and what they also showed, which will be important for later on, is that when people have individual CBT, when they're feeling depressed, their reactivity is significantly lower than if they just had antidepressants. So this reactivity is important, and if you look at it in people who've been through CBT or have got better in antidepressants, the ones who've had CBT tend to be less reactive. So CBT seems to be doing something about changing the amount these things come on board. So there's good evidence then that there is a plausible psychological model of why people who've had depression in the past might relapse in the future. We can test that and measure it in the laboratory and create this reactivity index, and we can show that the degree to which where you fall on that continuum determines or relates to your likelihood of relapse. So that's all very encouraging for trying to develop an intervention. So the intervention, which I'm going to talk about the process models of, is designed to try and intervene with that whole reactivity scenario and change the relationship between the influx of those kind of dysfunctional self-related beliefs and the chances of relapsing into a depressive episode down the line. So it's going to try and interfere with that cycle. So I'm not going to say much about FDCT, because I think people probably know a little bit about it anyway. It's something we should be proud of because it was developed in Cambridge. It's now a very widely used, NICE recommended evidence-based treatment. Something like 300 RCTs around the world are currently looking at FDCT. So it's really taken off in only a decade since it was first published. But I'll say a little bit about what it involves a bit later. So it emerged from some of the things I've already been talking about. So the idea was to take the best of, distill the best of what we know about cognitive therapy for depression in people who are currently not depressed but vulnerable to future relapse. So all the stuff about relapse signatures, your personal blueprint, what you need to look for when your mood is going down, all of the stuff that you would do towards the end of traditional cognitive therapy to help people build some kind of personalised relapse prevention kit, if you like. It also took this theoretical model I was just talking about relapse prevention, differential activation, what's likely to come into your mind when your mood begins to dip. And it combined it with work by Jon Kabat-Zinn, which has its origins in meditative approaches to mental life in the East, called mindfulness-based stress reduction. And it took aspects of that and combined it with these to come up with the therapy package. And what it's trying to do then is take this model that I talked about earlier, where people who are vulnerable to depression enter a negative mood, and then this constellation of very negative self-related mental structures come online with bodily and somatic implications and processes which maintain them, to take all of those, and rather than get in there and try to change them, which is what traditional CBT is trying to do, basically change the person's relationship to them. So a good metaphor for this, I think, is if you think of sort of a theatre-like metaphor. So imagine you're on the stage and you're interacting in a kind of a play about your life, where your lines are overlearned and you can only respond to things around you in these very rehearsed ways, which seem incredibly real. If you think about mindfulness, what it's trying to do is almost create a mental kind of balcony that people can sit up on and look down on what's going on in their mental life. Rather than take things as given, that I can only think in certain ways, and those ways are absolute truths about my life, to allow them to just take a step back to decenter from that and view those things a bit like a drama. These aren't actual truths about me. They're just mental events that are occurring in my mind. So I may have all these terrible thoughts and beliefs which are crowding in and seem incredibly real, such that most depressed people, when they're in this situation, would endorse them almost 100% as true. But actually, they're a function of this situation. And if I can find a way to step back and view them as mental states rather than as realities, then that's going to draw their sting so that they won't have the same power to push them down into the depressive episode. So that's really what it's trying to do. And it's using mindfulness-based techniques where people learn through meditative exercises to be present in the here and now and focus on their mental events in a very, very different way. So it's changing the relationship to your mental life as opposed to changing its content. So that's the key difference between CBT. So not an easy thing to do, and you can see why it's aimed at people when they're feeling pretty much okay. So the practicalities, so MBCT has a very well documented protocol which is available, but it's a group intervention, that's the main thing. 8 weeks of classes plus follow-ups, and up to 15 in each class. And it's important to say that it's a group intervention because MBCT practice as a therapist is very hard to do, and the training is quite intensive and you need quite specialised practitioners. So it's quite costly to train people to deliver the intervention. And a lot of that is offset by the fact that it's, in economic terms, a group intervention which has a good cost-benefit profile. So even though it's offered to people who are currently okay, and the practitioner training is quite expensive, it's still, the business case for MBCT seems to still be very strong. But it relies on being a group. And the other key thing to mention is it's quite intensive for the group members, so there's a lot of homework. And this I think is an interesting question which might come up later about MBCT, in that I think this puts a lot of people off doing it, and it also rules out a lot of people from doing it. You just can't manage that in the day-to-day life. But 6 days a week, up to an hour a day, often doing meditative practice. So it's quite intensive. Okay, so the questions that it's important to ask then are, do we have a theory about how some things work? Do we have basic science evidence that it might be working in that way? Well, we've got the theory of depressive relapse. We've got the evidential support that there is this differential activation. We've shown in the Seagal study that your degree of reactivity does seem to drive the degree of relapse. So you develop an intervention that tries to change that. So the next question is, does the intervention actually help? This is even before you try and wonder if it's working in the way you thought it would. So there's good evidence that MBCT is helping. So these are the first two trials which were done in Cambridge by John Teasdale. And then they're just being lumped together in this graph. So these are relapse rates over 60 weeks of people who entered into either MBCT compared to usual care, which in nearly every case was antidepressants, they are probably not a nice recommended criteria. So usual care versus MBCT, and looking at the percentage you've relapsed into a depressive episode over that time. And what you see is the figure I kind of mentioned earlier, about 66% of people in usual care have relapsed over 6 degrees. And that is much, much reduced in the MBCT. It's worth saying also that a lot of this group will have come off their antidepressants. Okay, so against usual care, which some people argue is a bit like pushing against an open door, because usual care is often patchy and not very good, it seems to be an effective intervention. The trial, which I'm going to talk about, the process data from, and these are colleagues I've been working with in Exeter on this work, Willem Pijken and his team down there. So this trial compared MBCT to an active intervention rather than usual care. So this is nice recommended levels of maintenance antidepressant. And the MBCT group have tapered their antidepressants. So nearly all of them, I think about 90% of them, come off antidepressants. And here, what you see is over 15 months, MBCT is still outperforming antidepressants, even though people have come off their antidepressants. So the effects aren't as strong as in the usual care trials, but they're still impressive. So it seems to be reducing the chances that people will relapse. If you know, this is what I was trying to say right at the beginning, even here, still nearly 50% of people are relapsed. So we can be pleased with our psychological treatments, but there's a long way to go. So the question then is, how is it working? So one would assume, based on the sort of collective delusion, I think I called it at the beginning, that, well, surely it's working by changing people's relationships to their mental life. And therefore reducing the effects of reactivity on relapse. Surely that must be how it works. We've got all the basic science, we've got the theory, we know it works, put everything together, it's only a school that to come to that assumption. But what we wanted to do was really test that out. So there's all sorts of ways you can understand how a treatment might work. You can do things called dismantling, where you can ask your funding body, can we have an extra arm of our trial at £1 million or whatever, where we just take out what we think is the active ingredient and see if the treatment wasn't working anymore. The general answer to that seems to be no, you can't. You can try and mimic what the active ingredients are in the lab. Say, well, we think the key thing is the mindfulness body scan, or we think the key thing is the meditation exercises and not the CBT relapse signature education component the package is that. And then you can just see, by looking at single components, can you get effects. Or you can take a treatment trial and embed process outcome measures within a big trial and see if the treatment effects in the trial seem to be working by changing the process measures in the reading effect. And that's the approach I'm going to talk about now. And it's remarkable that this doesn't go on all the time. So I'm a real fan of this approach. I think, you know, trials cost £2-3 million often, and putting in process outcome study embedded in the trial costs, you know, a few £1,000 extra. Routinely it doesn't go on. If we're going to really get serious about understanding how treatments work, it should be a completely routine approach. Okay, so we were going to just use a broad mediation approach. I'm not going to dwell on the statistical complexities of mediation. There's whole books written about the best way to look at it. But the general idea that we're interested in showing was that if you've got a comparison between two treatments in a trial, and this trial that I just told you was MBCT versus NICE recommended maintenance antidepressant medication for people who are currently okay, and you want to find something that mediates the effect of that treatment on outcome. And outcome is measured on are people relapsing and what's their degree of residual symptoms. So we use residual symptoms as well because over the year follow-up, which this trial used, it's only a platform trial, relapse is quite a crude measure because you're not going to get the range and the numbers to really give you a sense of the outcome. And we know that there's a massive relationship between residual symptomatology and relapse. So this gives us a really good proxy of the effects of treatment to augment the effects of relapse. So the question is then, if MBCT is going to improve relapse and reduce residual symptoms, is it going to be doing it by changing some variable that we think is supposed to be acting? So that's the key question that we're asking. And the criteria for that are, that variable has to be something that happens during treatment. So it's after someone's been randomized and it's before you measure their outcome. So whatever you're measuring that you think might be the active ingredient of MBCT, it has to actually be going on during that period. It also has to be changed by the treatment. So this is our other criteria. Whatever it is that we think is important, MBCT has to affect it more than antidepressants. And that might seem like, well, of course, but remember, for CBT, it was assumed that antidepressants wouldn't change cognitions as much as therapy, but in fact, that wasn't true. So it's quite an important criterion, which you think could just be absolutely given, but it isn't at all. And then the question is,
is the level of change in this variable related to how much better people get? So does the treatment change something, and does the amount that's changed lead to the improvements? Those are the questions you want to be asking for any variable you think is driving the treatment effect. Okay. Now there's different forms of relationship between the mediator and the outcome, and I'll talk about these in a second. So these are the process variables that we looked at in this first study, based on what I've tried to talk about before about the rationales. The first one was, hopefully, MBCT is making people more mindful, a greater ability to have a mindful relationship to their mental life than they did before. The whole idea of being able to move up to the balcony off the stage. So that's the first thing. Is MBCT making people more mindful? And does the degree to which their mindfulness improves relate to their improved outcome? So that's our first question. And again, we were motivated to ask this because of the very disappointing results of cognitive therapy. It should be obvious that this goes on, but we weren't at all confident that would be okay. The second one we focused on was self-compassion. So our question was, well, it's not just about being able to view the mental events that are going on when your mood goes down. You need to actually view them in a certain way. Because if you're viewing them and go, oh, there I am having all those thoughts about being a failure, the fact that I still have them just shows what a failure I am, and so on, which is a common problem when you're working in depression. You often get, well, I really understand what was said now, but the fact that I've had to come to you to come to this understanding just shows what a failure I was in the first place. It's a very difficult thing to work with. So what you need is a very self-compassionate view of what those things are. Yeah, I'm having these kind of experiences, but they're the sorts of things that experiences that lots of people have, and I don't need to give myself a hard time. And what's interesting about this variable is obviously MBCT trains people to be mindful, but it doesn't explicitly train self-compassion. What it tries to do is model self-compassion via the MBCT training practitioner. So their compassion to people's experiences models how people should be feeling about themselves. So it's quite explicitly taught. And I think the reason for that is as soon as you get people who are feeling a bit vulnerable to depression to try something explicitly, like we're going to do compassion training now, then that's just another thing where they can say, see, I can't even be self-compassionate about this situation. So it's modelled, it's not explicit. And I think that's very important. The problem is it means that MBCT practitioners have to be very compassionate people, and that immediately narrows the field of people. So self-compassion, so the degree of self-compassion that people are able to develop should be greater in MBCT than in antidepressants, and the degree of self-compassion they develop should relate to how much they get better. And the third one was this cognitive reactivity one. And here we have what's called an interactive mediation hypothesis. So we weren't saying that MBCT should make people less reactive and therefore they're going to get better. It's not the same as these relationships. We're saying MBCT may make people less reactive, it may make them more reactive. That's not the point. What it's going to do is change the relationship between reactivity and outcome. So it doesn't matter what comes into your mind. It could be more than people on antidepressants, it could be less. What's important is that's no longer going to make you vulnerable to relapse because you're not going to see it in the same way. You're not going to catastrophize those mental events. You're going to see them in a different way. So this relationship here will be broken. So what we thought was that MBCT may make people more reactive because they're going to be more accepting of mental events. It may make them less reactive. It might not have any difference. But what it will do is change this relationship. So we have this different. So our hypothesis were treatment effects will be mediated by increases in mindfulness and self-compassion, as I said. And then there'll be this interactive effect. The reactivity-outcome relationship will be nullified in MBCT, but it will stay like it is on that Seagal graph I showed you earlier. The more reactive you are, the more likely you are to relapse for the people who are in the process. It's that relationship that may be a distance. Okay, just briefly, the trial, so it's a platform trial, it wasn't a huge trial, 120 patients. We've all been on at least 6 months of antidepressants, and we're currently in partial full remission. And we measured levels of mindfulness before treatment and after treatment, and it's the change in mindfulness across treatment and the change in self-compassion across treatment that we're interested in. At the end of treatment, we then did this mood induction study with the Poppier and the statements, and we measured people's level of reactivity, and then we followed them up for a year. So what we wanted to know is, does the amount that mindfulness and self-compassion change here relate to how people are a year later, and does the level of reactivity here relate to people, how people are a year later, depending on what group they've been in. Yeah. And we did the skin for depression and for residual symptoms. A bit about the sample, just very briefly. As I said earlier, the number of 6 previous episodes, 20% more than 10 previous episodes. A fifth of the sample, history of suicide. So quite a severe time. The entry criterion was at least 3 previous episodes. So it's very brief.
Okay. The antidepressant kept going throughout that time, or was it a...
Okay, so in the MBCT, yes, so it's maintained throughout the whole year.
2 months.
Yeah.
So they're all playing the kids.
They're all recruited. Right.
How managed?
In the trial, the GPs managed antidepressants, but they were guided by the trial team to make sure they stayed at maximum levels. Okay. Not in the dosages. See that? Yeah. Okay, so the first question is, does MBCT make people more mindful? So these are the kinds of mindfulness questions. We use the standard mindfulness-based self-report measure. So these are the kinds of questions that are on it. So does MBCT make people more mindful? Well, yes, it seemed to, quite significantly. And does the degree of mindfulness that people acquire over the period relate to outcome? And yes, it did. So that was very, very reassuring and encouraging given the broader literature on cognitive-based therapies generally. There seems to be good evidence that MBCT does make people more mindful, and the more mindful you are, the less likely you are to relapse in the follow-up period. And this is over and above any changes in depression. So it's not just an epiphenomenon in depression. This is really important because this is where a lot of the previous mediation studies have fallen down. They've shown this effect and thought, great, then they've realized that actually it's just because mindfulness correlates with depression. So all these things, if we are less depressed, then not less likely. This is open about that. So next we looked at self-compassion. Does MBCT make people more self-compassionate? And we used again the standard measure of self-compassion, some items, these kinds of things. I'm kind to myself when I'm experiencing suffering. When things are going badly for me, I see the difficulties as part of life that everyone goes through. So the sorts of things I mentioned. So again, MBCT seems to make people considerably more self-compassionate than staying on antidepressants. And the degree to which people acquire a more self-compassionate stance reduces their chances of relapsing and having these issues. And again, this is all controlling. So what about reactivity? So the first thing, if we go back to the data in the literature, where we saw that actually, if people have been through CBT when they're depressed, their reactivity on this mood induction Prokofiev task is reduced compared to people who've only had antidepressants. What happens if people have had mindfulness? Well, actually, it's the opposite. If you've been through MBCT, you're more likely to endorse all these horrible self-related beliefs following mood induction. So the opposite effects. So it seems that the openness to experience component of MBCT, trying to encourage people to accept and to change the stance in their mental life,
one upshot of that is they're actually more aware of all these thoughts and feelings that happen to them when their mood goes down than they would be if they just in the anti-capacity. And certainly much more aware than, they certainly endorse them much more than people have been used to. So we were a bit surprised by this, because we thought if anything it would go the other way, or it might not change at all. We didn't expect people who'd been through MBCT to say, actually, following the induction, these things are in my mind a lot more than people have. So the question then is, okay, you've got all this stuff coming into your mind, even more than if you've just been on antidepressants. And at this point, we should be starting to worry, because it's like, well, so we've given you an intervention which has allowed you to be aware of what's going on in your mind, and what it's done is allow you to be aware of just how awful the things in your mind are. So that's very worrying, because if we know that the degree to which those things are present is a strong predictor of relapse, we could be in a lot of trouble. So first of all, we looked at the antidepressant group. So here we've got, this is residual symptoms, but you get a similar picture for relapse, because it's not been shown. So if we look at residual symptoms at the end of the trial, 15 months, and we've got low, average, and high levels of reactivity, then what we've got in the antidepressant group is the same as what we've seen before in the CGAL data. The more reactive you are, the more, like, the higher your levels of symptoms are followed up. So the standard relationship. So making people even more reactive with MBCT is going to be very concerning if this holds in the MBCT. But what did we find in the MBCT group? Absolutely nothing. So what we seem to have done is, regardless of what's going on in your mind, we've completely eliminated the relationship between reactivity and outcome. It doesn't make any difference if you've got all this stuff in your head or not. It no longer is a risk factor for future. So that was really, really encouraging for us. It shows that MBCT seems to be working on this relationship between reactivity and outcome. It's drawing the sting of all these things that are populating. So, what we seem to have then is one of the therapies that we have available to us seems to be changing the relationship between a low mood and the kinds of things that come into people's heads in the first place when they recover from depression and they experience a mood downturn. So if you've had cognitive therapy, it will have broken this relationship to some extent, and that's what we've seen in the CGAL data. Whereas if you have MBCT, it's actually not breaking this relationship at all. If anything, it's enhancing this relationship, but it's breaking this relationship. Whatever comes into your head doesn't seem to have the same chance of pushing you into it. So these therapies potentially operate at different points. So the next question we have, it's half past.
We're going to put it.
The next question we had, and I've nearly finished, was, well, is this really happening in the way that we thought it was happening? And we're pushing against the numbers a bit in this platform trial. But what we thought, as I said, was the reactivity is not going to be making you more vulnerable to relapse because you've changed your relationship to it and you've done that in a self-compassionate way. So the question is, Is this sort of flatlining of the reactivity-outcome relationship stronger the more self-compassion people have managed to develop through mindfulness? So in other words, it's the self-compassion that's causing this reactivity-outcome relationship to disappear. So that's what we looked at next. So this is technically moderated mediation. So and we found good support for that. So here you've got cognitive reactivity again. Are you low, average, or high on your reactivity to this mood induction? You've got outcome in terms of symptoms again. And what we've plotted it for is people who've had no real change in their level of self-compassion over treatment, people who've had an average level, and people who've had a high level. And what you can see is for people whose self-compassion hasn't really changed at all, you've still got this quite strong relationship between reactivity and outcome. And it's only those people whose self-compassion has significantly developed, but it's starting to eliminate that good relationship. So this gives us at least preliminary evidence that if we're gonna augment and develop MBCT, trying to reinforce the self-compassionate components of the intervention without touching it explicitly would be a way to go, because it seems to be what's driving this change. So very briefly then, where next? People who employ me, the MRC, who fortunately probably still employ me as we didn't get too many cuts yesterday, have developed a very clear framework about how you develop interventions from translation science. Obviously, we've gone through a lot of those with MBCT already. Detailed account of the clinical problem, where people say, when my mood goes down, this is the sort of things I think. Basic science studies to show that seems to be really the case. Coming up with a putative treatment that can intervene that MBCT. And then an exploratory or platform trial to show that that's where we're at now. And the next stage is a definitive RCT. We're the first year into our definitive trial now. So this is the PREVENT trial, and this gives me the opportunity to thank all my colleagues on this project and plug the people in yellow who are at the C2AD. So Cambridge has the pleasure of doing all of these mechanism studies in this big trial. So myself, Nick Wynne-Rand, who's our qualitative methods person in the centre, and obviously John Teasdale, who's still making sure we don't stray from the mindfulness. And again, it's a big trial to ask the definitive question. This time, is MBCT superior to the management centre depressions in preventing relapse in 24 months, 2 years? And the question that came again is not published to be is the sorts of things that we're talking about today, done on the largest scale. It's the same model as we talked about. Okay, so in summary, MBCT appears to be an efficacious intervention to prevent depressive relapse. It's recommended by an ISO, an evidence-based therapy. It seems to enhance mindfulness, fortunately, and self-compassion, and these do seem to be driving the pace and why people think that. It also seems to nullify the toxic relationship between reactivity and outcome, even though it seems to enhance reactivity. And this seems to be moderated, at least in our preliminary analysis in the platform trial, by the degree of self-compassion that people develop through the MBCT. The stage is now set for a definitive trial, which is ongoing. So hopefully I can come back in about 4 years. And it's finished. It's 500 patients here, so it's going to take a while. And the story might be completely different. It will just be an extension. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Is there any data to show that people continue to do the practice of training? Does that affect your outcome?
Yeah, so there are data from our platform trial now. It's very mixed in terms of the range. So some people seem to have had a sort of road to Damascus type experience, and it's become part and parcel of their daily life. Most people are doing it every now and then, and it's a bit like, I suppose it's a bit like all of us. You've got personal regimes which you put in place when you can see your life starting to go a bit ragged around the edges. So they kind of, it's a sort of needs must basis, and then other people have stopped completely. There just isn't the power really in data to systematically look at relationship and that outcome over and above all these other factors. What we did look at was a per protocol versus an intended true analysis. So people who've been through the whole program and continue to practice rather for at least half the program versus intended true. And that certainly seemed to be. Make the effects not stronger. So, yeah, at least doing the initial stuff seems to help. We just haven't got the power data, but the definitive trial will definitely have to be able to understand that. And I think it's really important because if MBCT's effects require you to continue doing this all the time, then I'm not sure personally how viable it is to roll out NHS intervention. if it's about you can change people's relationships and then they don't need the end mindfulness practice to keep you kind of change something and it's always available to look at things in a different way, then I think it's got more legs.
I really like this very much, except that, as you know, I don't like mindfulness at all. But the way that you're talking about it, I don't think you need to do the mindfulness bit. I think that there might be a... Because the important thing seems to be that you break the link between the reactivity and the outcome. You get onto, you find a way of getting onto the balcony, and you become compassionate towards yourself. And I don't think you need mindfulness to do those things. I think that you... Actually, I think I do some of those in the way that I do cognitive therapy, and I think that, we can find ways of doing that better without the mindfulness.
Absolutely. I really wish you'd been on the NIHR board for our Instant Trial, because we had a third arm, which was everything but the mindfulness. Yeah. And our view was that it's really important, because if we can do all this without the mindfulness, we get the same effects, then that makes no sense.
Yeah.
And they said,
I don't think that more ordinary CBT does increase mindfulness to the extent that you're identifying concepts like negative automatic thoughts, probably for the first time.
Yeah.
We've never looked at
it. I think it absolutely does. If you do it in the right way, it teaches disengagement from that negative stream. That is a lot of what you're talking about, so yeah.
And it's a critical question, but it's really simple. My view is a big problem with mindfulness is it's just very difficult to get people to do it.
And it's the reasons that do
it. And people like you to both say the reason. And if you could get its effects in a much more practical way, then you know, it's hard to get the end. I agree theoretically.
I was just going to ask another possibility I thought about with the reactivity. So this group that became more reactive with mindfulness, they became more reactive to depressive stimuli, but perhaps also they became more reactive to positive stimuli. So maybe you should design an experiment where you put them in a room with positive vibes and see if they get more pleasure out of it.
Yeah.
Maybe a deterrent to anhedonia, which is a symptom of depression.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point. So there's a question about whether when you become more reactive, it's the domain general is more reactive. And so, okay, it does make you more reactive to sad stuff, but it feels more reactive to positive stuff as well. So we put some measures in place in the difference. Basic science literature suggests that they dissociate quite a bit, but interestingly, in interesting ways of depression. So what you find is that people who are depressed are actually, the degree to which they have reduced positive reactions, positive things, is much stronger than the degree to which they have increased negative reactions to negative things. But they're only a little bit less. But it's the anhedonia that's really, really strong. And so that gives some hope to the way you're thinking. And that's completely different to the standard clinical assumption study, what I'm going to ask for, which is a lot of it's fixed on negative conditions and feelings and the fact that the basic science has been showing is a huge amount of reducing and that they dissociate. So it's not.
Last question, Charlie. Question about the actual memory process that might be involved when this has been learned. So how are you able to say anything about that, whether it's implicit learning or whether it's another form of learning that is involved when something comes to mind for an effect? Is it an automatic sort of
thing? Yeah, no, I haven't. No, I don't know. What we're trying to do in cognitive therapy is address that very question. based on the negative assumption, like you're trying to challenge the way you're thinking in CBT ways, it doesn't become automatic. It's really effortful. And part of the reason people realize it is because they just have more mental capacity to effort free. A, remember what this question is challenging and changing, and B, to put it into place. And one way around that is to use cognitive training regime and use just for granted. Adjunctive to CBT, which actually really hammers home, to automatize this process. So what you've got in mindfulness, you have got a